This is the United States Dressage Federation's official podcast. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Chris Stafford, and on this week's episode, we remember USDF Hall of Fame inductee Carl Milkolka. Frank Pellegrini offers part two of Gastrointestinal Health in the Equine Athlete, and our freestyle tip of the week comes from Anne Guptill on Pas de Deux. But before we hear from Anne, the USDF has announced its newest certified instructors following the exam that was held from April 10th to the 13th at Hilltop Farm in Cholera, Maryland. Lisa Lewis of Greenfield Center, New York, Erin Sweeney of Gordonville, Virginia, and Jeanette Scanlon of Auburn, California, received their certification at first level, and those successful at second level included Tiffany Bragdell of Cholera, Maryland, and Karen Roberts of Southwick, Massachusetts. Michael Bragdell of Cholera, Maryland, and Janet Use of Rome, Pennsylvania, achieved their certification at third through fourth level. The examiners were Mariel Barnett and Debbie Bauman. For more information, please visit the website at usdf.org under News. Anne Guptill from East Haddon, Connecticut, is a USDF certified instructor through fourth level and a certification examiner. She's also a member of the USDF Instructor, Trainer, and Freestyle Committees and an L graduate, and is also a USDF Bronze, Silver, and Gold medalist. She was also a member of the silver medal winning team at the 1987 Pan American Games.
Pas de Deux is a great introduction for someone who may be new to freestyle and prefers riding with a partner than trying it on their own the first time.
So what advice would you give them to get started?
First, know that they have a partner who would be comfortable riding in pairs work or in mirror image that the horse, and a lot of horses do, but some horses get a little nervous or uncomfortable about it. But most horses, because of their herd instinct, do prefer riding with a partner.
Now, would you look for a same type of horse, the same look of horse, same color and that sort of thing? What would be the first things to address?
If that's possible, if they're of the same height, same type, that just makes the pas de deux easier to perform if they are a mirror image of each other.
So what would be the next steps then once you've chosen your partner?
Size, as long as with the partner, things to consider also, again, are size, level, ability, and availability to practice, because there will be time needs to be set aside to practice together. So that can be worked around work schedules, stable schedules, lesson schedules, etc. Then the next most important is the music that will highlight both horses and highlight the movements that they choose to do.
And once they've decided that, what's the next stage?
Choreography after, once they have the music, the choreography. And they can also work that hand in hand, just as with a freestyle, you can work the choreography and set the music to it later, or you can choose the music and do the two hand in hand. And things for the pairs to think of are, again, with the size matching, and they can also, that is included in the score, if they can make the pairs look mirror image. Their image is suitability and their turnout is considered in the scoring.
And what else would the judges be looking for in that general impression?
In the general impression for pas de deux? Anything different than freestyle with the pairs is their spacing. There is spacing, of course, in regular freestyle, but the alignment of the pairs. Do they match up when they're mirror image, when they're side by side? Are they close enough together? Are they able to match? If they can match beat per beat, that is just really moving for the judges and the office and the judges, for the judges and the audience, excuse me. Synchrony as a pair, can they do things at the same time? Can they time the transitions together? If they're doing flying changes, can they time the flying changes together? That just adds to the impact of the performance.
And what else would they be looking for then overall? Give us some more ideas of some good tips when you're making that selection.
The selection of the music or the selection of the partner?
All of these things.
Okay. Selection of the music, there has, just as with freestyle, good highlights for movements such as it suggests, if the music suggests a half pass or the music suggests an extension or a lengthening, timing of the transitions in the music with the transitions of the horses, phrasing that matches the movements, so that if a certain phrase in the music starts, they start the half pass at the same time, they end the half pass with that phrasing in the music. The music has to have enough dynamic to support the movements and the type of horse that it is. Suitability of music would be, you know, not a big sounding orchestra might overwhelm a small moving horse. And the opposite, a very light string performance may not highlight a big moving horse.
And so, it, obviously, putting this program together is double of what you would do if you were doing an individual freestyle. So it really has to be synchronized in every aspect. What else would we be looking for?
In the pas de deux, beyond the regular freestyle, important that combinations used can match up with the, there are fewer, the guidelines in pas de deux, there is a one overall pas de deux score sheet for training through fourth level. And then once they get to the FEI levels, those are FEI score sheets. But the USDF score sheets are training through fourth. And the riders have to be familiar with what are the forbidden and what are the allowed movements at each level. And they need to be clever with arranging some combinations that may be different than found in regular tests, so that it does not look like a test just set to music. It's a different creation with this pair in mind as it was created and with the music in mind.
Give us an idea of some of those forbidden movements so we know what to look out for, Anne, in the pas de deux.
Certainly. In freestyle, below third level, a single flying change is not allowed. And then horses that may, and again, riders may be using, by riding a lower level in their freestyle and their pas de deux than they are in regular competition. So if they have a third level horse but are choosing to do a second level freestyle or pas de deux, they have to be very careful that they don't put a flying change in, because there will be a deduction for movements above the level. That deduction's only taken once, even if it happens two or three times, but that particular. So if a horse did a flying change both directions, it would only be deducted once, not twice. Riders doing in fourth level a half pirouette have to be careful that it not go more than a half. It will be penalized if it was greater than a half pirouette. Approaching a full pirouette or even a three-quarter pirouette can get a deduction. And then those are typical ones that can be, that are easy to slip by. Counter canter is clearly allowed in first level. Zigzag trot, once they trot half passes, can be done. They are allowed for certain, and that's a good use of expression and creativity. And again, combinations of how they put the movements together. For example, in first level, going from a lengthening directly to a 10-meter circle in a corner, or a 10-meter circle directly to a lengthening. So the judges will take into account when scoring that, that those are two movements linked together. And that could be very powerful with, if you had a horse circling in each corner and then lengthening across the diagonal together, that could be very powerful, very good impact on the judges and the audience.
And what do you see as the typical mistakes from those people that are starting in the pas de deux and entering for the first time as a combination?
Trying to do things that may be a little bit above the difficulty, you know, trying for a degree of difficulty that may be too much for the horse, or doing movements too repetitively. It needs to be interesting to watch. Again, the mistakes of showing something above the level, being clear that movements are recognizable, that both can do the movement well, because it's important that both horses do the movements. You know, if you have one horse that does not do one movement well, can't really hide it. It needs to be, both horses need to do all the movements of the level. For example, placing the lateral exercises such as shoulder in or haunches in a place that they can clearly be seen by the judges.
And any final thoughts then, as people think, well, this might be just the thing for them to find a partner and make their way into pas de deux and design a freestyle. Any final thoughts, Anne?
It can be a really good way for someone, to break into freestyle. It's a good social aspect for the horses and for the riders, because the riders can help each other. If they're watching each other when they're schooling the movements, they can give each other hints. Scheduling that practice time together and sticking to it can really give a really good feeling of accomplishment when it's done. And also, pas de deux can be used as an exhibition. It can be used in a fundraising event, for example, an exhibition at another event for fundraising for charities, or for just a fun event at an annual meeting for perhaps a riding club or something like that. It can be, if well done, it can be a real highlight for audiences and not necessarily used in competition. So not, you know, thinking of that they might develop it as something of an exhibition and then use that as practice for them before they go to a recognized show. So that they're very comfortable with their timing, with their partner, with the timing, with the music, because, of course, adding one more variable with the other horse and rider can add other consequences if one horse is not right.
A great way to enjoy your dressage to music. Thank you very much indeed, Anne, for giving us this tip this week.
Thank you.
Our next topic is taken from an education session at the 2013 Adequan USDF Annual Convention, in which Frank Pellegrini introduces Dr. Nikki Carbison to talk about the risks of colic.
Dr. Nikki Carbison here, she's over here visiting. She's been with us for a week from Scotland. She's working on her PhD right now. She's been a practicing veterinarian for about 6 years, and I think you'll enjoy a lot of the risk factors that she's going to give you for colic.
Yeah. I'm based in the epidemiology department, which is where we look at risks of disease, and we're really quite focused on statistics, and we're trying to look at the evidence. I'm very focused on evidence-based meds. So first of all, really, how common is colic? Well, you'll see there's probably about 20 different studies which have told us how common colic is. And with any of these studies, we have to look at the population, because one might look at racehorses in one particular area, and another might look at wild horses. And really, we've got to consider that the incidence there is going to be quite different. But overall, the general consensus is about 5 to 10 cases per 100 horses per year. So if you have one horse, you can expect it to colic for about every 10 to 20 years. If you have 20 horses, you can probably expect about a colic a year. That would be what we would say is normal. I tried to find something more America specific, and I found in Michigan 3.5 cases per 100 horse years. So you would have to look at these studies in detail to try and work out why these were less common in Michigan in particular, but that's kind of the rough numbers. However, we do know that after a horse has had one episode of colic, about 23% of them will then go on to colic again in the next 2 years. However, what I'm going to then go on and tell you now is lots of things which we have determined which increase that risk substantially. So this would be the baseline level of colic. I wouldn't be worried if you had a horse that colicked every 10 years. I think it's probably just one of these things. There are things which will increase the risk substantially, and we'll try and look at those things. So why does it matter? I think primarily we're concerned about the welfare of our animals. And obviously colic is not a nice thing. It's horrendous to see your animal colicking, and we try to prevent that as much as possible. But then directly related to the competitor, I think we have to consider loss of training days. Even as a practitioner, if a horse had a severe bout of colic, I would really advise do nothing with it for a week, even if that would be if it was just treated medically, not surgically, obviously. Give it some time off. And if that's just coming right up to an important event, then that's obviously quite significant. Loss of competition days, treatment costs, which we can't ignore, and obviously death. So the outcome of colic in one particular study, about 29% of horses recovered from it spontaneously. This is with no treatment. And that might have been, they might have had a vet examination at that point, but equally they might not have been. This was specifically looking at thoroughbreds in race training. So I suspect in that population, there'll be more which are left for an hour before the vet is called, I suspect. So, and I think often some, a proportion of colics will resolve within an hour. I think the difficulty is it's quite difficult at the early stages to determine which ones are going to resolve in an hour. And if your vet's an hour away, sometimes that time difference can make a huge difference. So that's why we would always advise you to err on the side of caution. Medical recovery, this is with some form of medical treatment, whether that is fluids administered or drugs, 63% will recover. 2% will go on to have surgery and recover, and 6% death rate in colic, which I think is actually, for all it looks like a small segment of that pie, I think that is quite a significant death rate. If we look at most of the other conditions that horses get, it is certainly not something we can ignore. And looking at the mortality rate of colic overall, per 100 horse years, we can expect 0.45 deaths directly due to colic. So just a bit of an explanation. We have to bear in mind that epidemiology is a study of disease risks and patterns within a defined population. So it's almost impossible to do a study of all horses and all management systems. Generally, each study will focus on one group. Therefore, what I'm about to say might not be relevant to your horse. And I have tried to pick out, where possible, those that are relevant to the dressage horse. But, and you know, it's probably quite depressing, actually. Everything increases the risk of colic. But I think we have to kind of take that into the context in which it is presented, which is that this is a defined population. And the other thing is, most of these studies are what we call multivariate analysis. And whenever you have a group of animals and you're studying disease, you can almost never create an exact same set of circumstances in every horse, with the exception of one thing, whatever you're looking at, whether that's colic or whatever. These horses, even in a defined group, will have differences in management, they'll have differences in feeding practices. And so therefore, the way we try and look at it statistically is we try to isolate that one thing of interest and see if it's significant without the other factors. But you have to bear in mind that these studies, they're not perfect, because in a perfect world, we'd have 100 identical horses in an identical regime, but it doesn't really happen that way. So looking first at recurrent colic, and what is recurrent colic? Some would say more than one episode per year. Some would say more than three episodes per lifetime. But really, any horse which colics kind of more than once in a short space of time, I would say, has recurrent colic. And this particular study in Texas in 1996 looked at a number of factors, and the list were the ones that they found increased the risk of a horse colicking more than once. So age greater than 8 years, which I think we could probably guess. Geldings, don't know why that is. Arabians, my experience of Arabians is that they don't have a high pain threshold. So I suspect that Arab horses show colic signs when some other horses would just get on with it. So I don't know if that's a true reflection of the breed or just that they have difference in pain thresholds. Recent change of diet, which we know, feeding of coastal grass hay, previous abdominal surgery, that's a given. Recent change in stabling, and less than 0.5 horses per acre. So you would think that a higher density of horses in a small field would increase the risk, but that's certainly not what they found in this study. Another study in the UK also looked at recurrent colic in 2011, and the only three things that they found of significance here were those which were crib biters, windsuckers, or those with dental problems. So moving on to look at stabling versus pasture turnout. We know that horses that are stable 24/7 are about three times more likely to colic than those that have some period of turnout. And we also know that some types of colic, for example, cecal impaction, not eating any grass massively increases the risk of a cecal impaction approximately 30 times. However, we also know that there are some diseases which only happen in horses which eat grass, such as grass sickness, which I know you don't have a huge problem with here, but we do in the UK. So you have to balance all these things out. And also, if you were to look at the risk of wounds, they would be significantly increased in horses that are turned out. So we can't just... This isn't a recipe for how to look after your horse. This is just for you to try and work out what's the right thing for you to do. And looking at dietary risk factors. So with any diet, there's kind of three things which we control: the type of food we're giving, the quality, and the quantity. And all these will have an effect on the ingesta, so that's the contents of the gastrointestinal tract. It then goes on to then affect the pH, hydration of the intestinal contents, osmolarity, gas and the amount of froth production. And all of these things are in kind of very tight balance. It doesn't take much to change the concentration of one of these things to a point at which it can cause a problem. So looking at cereals, we know that the risk of colic overall increases significantly when horses are fed concentrates or cereals. So moderate cereal intake of about 6 pounds a day, about 5 times the risk of colic compared to the same horse that wasn't fed any cereals. And once we go over the 5 kilo cutoff, that would be about 12 pounds, gives us 6 times the risk. We know, I mean, I'm not an equine nutritionist specifically, but we know that high starch, low fibre diets causes dehydration of the intestinal contents. And then obviously the starch presence there changes the metabolism completely and also alters the pH. Looking at roughage, we know that certain types of hay do increase the risk. Not everyone necessarily knows the sort of hay they're using, but you can usually get it analysed if you don't know. Coastal Bermuda grass hay and alfalfa both increase the risk for specific things. So coastal Bermuda grass hay increases the risk of a type of impaction called an ileal impaction, which is quite hard to diagnose. And alfalfa increases the risk of enteroliths, which are these little concretions of matter which you can get within the gastrointestinal tract. And both oat and grass hays have been found to be protective. Looking at geographical factors, actually every study I read tells me something different, so I don't think we can really take much about geography. I think it really depends on so many other factors. The only two things which are significantly affected by geography are enteroliths, which happen generally in kind of round about California on the west coast sort of area, but can happen anywhere. And southeastern USA, we tend to get this sort of syndrome called duodenitis, proximal duodenitis, which is small intestinal inflammation effectively. Season, I think most of us are aware that changes in season do cause an increase in colic. And we touched on that before. We don't quite know why that happens. But certainly when I was in practice, I was very aware that people would wonder why when it snowed, all their horses would colic. And then you would ask them, well, what would the horse's normal management be? It was turned out, what have you done today? I've kept it in. I've given it more concentrates because it's in. I've not ridden it. So actually just we try to protect our horses from adverse weather. So we tend to change their management because we think it's the right thing to do. It might well be the right thing to do, but we may well be inadvertently increasing colic risks just by doing these things. Time of year, so many different studies say different things, so I wouldn't pay too much attention to that, to be honest. So I tried to look at things which were kind of specific for dressage horses, and we know that warm bloods are increased risk of dorsal displacements, which is where a piece of large intestine moves into the wrong place. And we think that probably the reason for that is that warm bloods have a very large space in which guts can move around. They're very deep chested generally, so probably there's a bit more capacity for things to move around. And we know that thoroughbreds and Arabs are generally at increased risk of colic overall. I would again say that I think that might be partly due to pain threshold. We do know that crib biting and windsucking do significantly increase the chance of colic and recurrent colic. And certainly if I was buying a horse that had one of these vices, I would bear that in mind. It's not just an inconvenience, it actually is quite a lot more likely to colic in that particular horse. There's varying reports out there. Some people say 2 times the risk, some people say 12 times the risk. With certain types of colic, the risk is almost only seen in windsuckers and crib biters. So it really does depend on the type of colic that we're talking about. Regular exercise, some people say this causes a slight increase in risk, although I would wonder, is it because horses that are exercised spend less time at pasture, and we know that pasture is protective. So I wouldn't be too concerned about regular exercise. And we also know that increased risk following transport in the previous 24 hours. And again, we have to think about that as a multifactorial thing. Is it because they've been stressed at transport? Is it because they've not been drinking so well, or their routine's been changed? There are lots of things. Most of these things, with the exception of crib biting and windsucking, cause a marginal increase in risk. So I wouldn't spend too much time worrying about them. And just other factors. So owners being the only person to look after a horse gives a protective effect against the risk of colic. So horses with one caregiver are approximately 58% chance of colicking compared to those which have multiple caregivers. And I suspect that comes down to routine and consistency. We know, and everyone knows this, changes in routine. However, one of the major things with regards to routine is a new batch of hay. So try, if it were possible, to not have more new batches of hay than you have to. Try to just do it once a year or whatever you can. And this one, more horses on a premises results in less colic. With more than 18 horses, a significantly decreased risk. That again was a UK-based study. The only explanation I can have for this is perhaps larger yards have more consistent routines, perhaps. So what can you do to minimise the risk? I think most of this is pretty common sense. Make all your dietary changes gradually. If you can, turn your horse out every day, even if it's only for an hour or two. I think we kind of talk about Dr. Green in the UK. I don't know if you talk about that here, but good old grass is one of the best things for them. So if they can have some time outside every day, try to minimise how often you get a new batch of hay. Feed only the concentrates you require. We like to think that keeping on giving concentrates to our horses is going to improve their performance, but actually quite a high proportion of performance horses are slightly overweight, so you probably find that most people are giving too much concentrate. Try to always have ad lib fibre. Sometimes, certainly with the race horses, the reason they don't eat much hay is they're so full from the amount of concentrates they have, which is because they have to in order to perform. But if possible, try to have your horse eating or have food in front of it all the time. If your horse is a windsucker or a crib biter, try to avoid it ingesting air at the same time. So use a collar. It does look a bit unpleasant, but they don't seem to mind it too much, and certainly it will reduce its risk of colic. And also, I haven't gone into parasites specifically because I didn't have time, but if we can maintain adequate dental and parasite treatment, that will also reduce the risk. And also, I think there has to be a degree of acceptance that we can't remove the risk of colic. All we can do is try to minimise it.
And in our final segment this week, we take a moment to remember another USDF Hall of Fame inductee. Carl Milkoka was inducted into the USDF Hall of Fame in 2003 in recognition of his contributions to the development and promotion of classical dressage in the US. He trained many Lipizzan stallions to Grand Prix and in airs above the ground, and introduced thousands of spectators to dressage at the Temple Lipizzan summer performances. He taught many successful students throughout the US and wrote several pioneering articles on dressage. Milkoka started riding as a teenager at the racetrack in Vienna, Austria, and entered the Spanish riding school at the age of 19. He remained there for 14 years and achieved the rank of Oberbereiter, or chief rider, before he left in 1968. Milkoka then moved to Brazil with his former wife Cindy, now Cindy Sidnor, to develop the first Brazilian Olympic dressage team. In 1972, Milkoka fulfilled a childhood dream by relocating to the United States. He was one of the first European instructors and trainers who arrived in the US and brought the principles of European training to the isolated pocket of dressage interest. He soon established the Massachusetts Dressage Academy in an attempt to provide a systematic educational dressage curriculum. He is a founding member of the USDF and attended the first organizational meeting in February 1973 in Lincoln, Nebraska. In the mid-1970s, he became an AHSA dressage judge and served on the judging panel of several Olympic selection trials at Gladstone, New Jersey. Milkoka moved to Wadsworth, Illinois in 1980, where he became a trainer at Temple Farms, home of more than 400 Lipizzan stallions. Owners Temple and Esther Smith had a vision of creating another Spanish riding school in the US. Milkoka trained and rode Lipizzans for the Temple Lipizzan summer performances, training them to Grand Prix and in airs above the ground. He introduced thousands of spectators to classical dressage at these performances. Milkoka has been a successful trainer, coach, and instructor to many hundreds of students throughout the US, including well-known riders Belinda Nairn Wertmann, Carol Grant Offord, Cindy Sendor, and George Williams. His ability to communicate difficult technical principles has won him the respect of students around the country. Milkoka continues to disseminate his teachings through his website, Carl's Corner, and in articles such as Selection and the Use of Spur, published in 1994, To Bend or Not to Bend, 1996, The Double Bridle, Considerations and Applications, 1996, Bausch's Methods, 1997, A Few Thoughts on the Use of Drawrains, 1998, and The Keys to a Straight Back, 1998. Milkolka left Temple Farms in 1996 and relocated with his wife Lynn to Gloucester, Massachusetts. He continues to teach clinics throughout the U.S. Milkolka has made an outstanding contribution to the development of dressage in the U.S. by teaching the technical aspects of the sport to American riders, providing them with the foundation they need to be competitive internationally. His impact on dressage in the U.S. has been profound in the areas of teaching, training, writing, and judging. You can find more information about Carl Milkolka and an article entitled The Neck of the Horse in the May issue of The Connection magazine. This podcast is available for download on iTunes. Be sure to visit eTrack, the USDF's online learning center and resource for dressage and equine education, at usdf.org. The USDF is your connection to the American dressage community.